Okay. All right, so I guess we'll start. So my name's Jaggi, and I'm a member of the No One Is Legal campaign here in Montreal. And this workshop is entitled No One Is Legal. And basically, what I'm going to try to do is provide an analysis of this emerging and existing set of politics that revolves around these slogans, open borders, no one is illegal, no borders. It's a huge topic. I don't pretend that I'm going to be comprehensive. We're talking about migration, immigration, refugees, issues that are enormous, that affect literally masses of people directly. And I think it affects all of us really directly. And my analysis that I'm going to try to provide is based on the lived reality of migrants and refugees. It's a really important point. It's not based on trying to abstract away from what people actually experience every day. So I'm going to try to refer to real-life examples, some organizing examples that some people here in Montreal have been involved with the No One Is Legal campaign. One proviso I want to make, though, is I'm not going to be comprehensive. Like I said, this is a huge topic, migration, immigration, refugees. And the view I'm presenting doesn't represent the view of the group that I'm a member of, necessarily. I'm a member of a group called No One Is Illegal. There's a lot of different members. There's other people who will be speaking at the book fair. Actually, Harsha Walia already spoke at the Anarchists Against the War panel. And later on today, Sarita, who's a member of our group, she'll be speaking as well on another panel. Actually, I agreed with everything Harsha said, and I probably agree with everything Sarita says. So I'm not here saying that my point of view is different from anyone else's. I just want to make it clear that I'm not representing the group, but I'm just presenting some ideas here. So I guess the first place to start is, what does it mean to have an anarchist perspective on anything? Like, I'm going to analyze migration, but what does it mean to have an anarchist perspective? And I guess it's important to maybe provide some of my ideas about anarchism and how it relates to organizing. I don't think an anarchist perspective simply means that you have consensus decision making or that you don't have any leaders and therefore you're anarchist. It's a lot more than that. Anarchism is a political philosophy. It's also a practice. It's a historical tradition, and it's a contemporary praxis. And it not only attacks capital, but it attacks the power of capitalism, which is law, authority, and the state. But I'm an anarchist who believes in organization, and I believe anarchism is part of a left tradition. I'm not shy about saying so. And anarchism is only meaningful when it's related to and involved with real life struggles of real life people dealing with oppression in any one of its forms, whether it's an oppression, a cultural oppression, whether it's a sexist oppression, whether it's the oppression of someone who's a worker, the oppression that's aimed at migrants and immigrants, etc. Anarchism is only meaningful in the context of that struggle, and that's where we kind of test our ideas, and that's where our ideas take meaning. I don't see an anarchist perspective about being about anarchists having the right ideas and then going to a given struggle, say immigrants or refugees or workers, and saying this is the way you should go. Rather, we as anarchists have our ideas, and we make our ideas more profound and deepen those ideas within those struggles, because those struggles are the front lines of oppression. So just to give to paraphrase a quote, famous quote from the Platformist, but I'm going to paraphrase it just to make it more modern. Anarchism does not derive from the abstract reflections of an intellectual or a philosopher, but from the direct struggle of people against oppression. The original quote was workers against capitalism, but I'm saying people against oppression. From the needs and necessities of people, from their aspirations to liberty and equality, aspirations which become particularly alive when people are self-active, when they self-organize. And when people are self-organizing against oppression, that's when we should be involved in those struggles, not as a vanguard, but also not as followers, but as allies. And I'm going to talk a little bit later about what that means. So that's, very briefly how I see an anarchist perspective. Now, there's obvious things as well that I'm not stating, because I'm assuming that, there's some basic knowledge of people here about, anarchist values of mutual aid and solidarity. Those values are some of the values that bring us to these struggles. The fact that an injury to one is an injury to all. And that's why we are concerned about struggles that relate to immigrants, struggles that relate to workers, struggles that relate to women, etc., because they relate to us as well. Anarchists are anti-statist. And any campaign that's questioning borders and questioning what governments do is inherently an anarchist thing as well. So those are somewhat obvious things, I think. But I'm sort of saying something that might not be as obvious, which is I think anarchism is only meaningful in the context of a social struggle, not some abstraction. So based on that, I'm gonna talk a little bit about migration, and then go back to this idea of an anarchist perspective. So let's talk about the reality of migration. You know, where does this analysis of no one is illegal or open borders come from? Well, I guess the first thing to do is acknowledge that reality of migration, the fact that there are literally millions of people every year that are crossing national borders. And when I say they're crossing national borders, they're not crossing as tourists, they're crossing for some permanent purpose. According to the United Nations, this is an updated statistic, there's 175 million people every year that are crossing national borders for one reason or another. And that doesn't include people who are crossing borders within their own, people who are migrating within their own country. For example, people in Colombia that are displaced within their country. So excluding people who are displaced within their own nation, there are 175 million people on the move every year crossing national borders. This is an unprecedented level of human movement ever in human history. We've never had this number of people moving. This is double what it was 10 years ago. And according to the United Nations, it's expected to double again in another 10 years. So we have an enormous amount of movement going on, people crossing national borders. And the numbers tell one story, right? 175 million. What does that really say? We can talk about other things. We can talk about the tragedies of these journeys. For example, people cramming onto ferries and those ferries sinking. There was a famous case in Australia, well, from Indonesia to Australia, of a ferry crammed with migrants from Algeria, from Palestine, from Iraq and Afghanistan. Trying to get from Indonesia to Australia, the ferry was overcrowded, that it cracked in two, and over 350 people drowned, including over 100 children. That happened in the year 2000. We could talk about containers, where people are crammed into containers, and literally, you can see people's fists imprinted on the metal because they're suffocating, and they die of suffocation in those containers, trying to get, say, from France to England under the Channel. That happened 2 years ago. Just last week, you might have read about a truck in Texas, where 17 migrants from Mexico and Central America suffocated to death. There were over 100 crammed in there. And the trucker opened it up and saw the corpses and got so freaked out that he undid the hitch and just took off. And there are others that are now in critical condition in the hospital because of the suffocation. I mean, these are stories that are more common than we think. All kinds of tragedies. Beyond the tragedies, there are the risks that people take just to get from one place to another. There are over 2,000 people that have died trying to cross to the U.S. side of the Mexican-American border in the last 10 years, over 2,000. And you can talk about, say, the people from North Africa that are trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to get to Italy or to Spain. We can talk about the incredible journeys that people take from Afghanistan to get to Pakistan or to get to Indonesia, and on and on and on. So there's the risks. And then, of course, there are the consequences of these journeys, because at the end of these journeys, there's not necessarily a great welcome. There are refugee camps that are often squalid, that are in horrible conditions. Detention. And if those Iraqis or Afghanis had got to Australia, they'd be put in a detention center, which is more accurately called, I think, a concentration camp in the middle of the desert. And if people avoid being in a squalid refugee camp or they avoid being in detention, they often have to live clandestine, illegal, unstable lives wherever they might be. So these are the realities of the 175 million people who are crossing borders every year. But beyond, you know, this is sort of a very negative picture I'm painting here, and it's an accurate picture too. It's not unduly negative, it's accurate. People are dying, people are taking risks. They are living in squalid conditions in refugee camps. They are in detention centers in the middle of deserts. They are living clandestine, unstable lives. But these journeys that people are taking are also very courageous, and they're also acts of self-determination. Anarchists support self-determination. That is, individuals or groups of people determining how they want to live their individual or collective lives. And people deciding to make that decision to move, those are incredible expressions of self-determination. And that really should be our starting point, whether we're anarchists or not, of how we deal with this issue of migration. People are required to get false passports. People are required to deal with smugglers. I always think it's important to make the distinction between smuggling and trafficking. Trafficking is when you take a human being and are using them for some purpose, like trafficking women and forcing them into the sex trade. That's trafficking. But smuggling is simply moving somebody from one place to another, clandestinely. And it can be an exploitive thing, but it can simply just be the act of moving somebody from one place to another. And in this modern-day context where smuggling is, you know, or immigration in general is scapegoated and there's all kinds of racist connotations, I think we should remember some of the famous smugglers of history. You know, like Harriet Tubman. She was a smuggler. If people don't remember who Harriet Tubman was, she was one of the black women that was a key organizer of the Underground Railway. She smuggled slaves, ex-slaves, into Canada, into the northern United States. She was a smuggler. There are two people who have won honorary Canadian citizenships in Canadian history. And, you know, in an anarchist book fair, we really don't care about honorary citizenship. But still, I mean, I think the point is that when that is awarded, it's awarded to, you know, sometimes quite remarkable people. And the two people who have been awarded honorary Canadian citizenships are pretty remarkable people. One is Nelson Mandela, you know, who spent, with all his faults, he spent over two decades in prison for his cause. And the other one, which is not as well known, is a fellow by the name of Raoul Wallenberg. Raoul Wallenberg was a Swedish diplomat, and he provided fake passports to Jews so that he could flee Nazi-occupied Europe and come to other countries. And he was also awarded honorary Canadian citizenship. Not every smuggler is of the caliber of Harriet Tubman or Raoul Wallenberg, but my point is smuggling is different than trafficking. And this is the reality of what refugees, migrants, immigrants deal with, and that's our starting point. And also, beyond the courage and self-determination, there's the amazing expression of solidarity and mutual aid that people are providing to migrants that we don't acknowledge. You know, like often, you know, as anarchists, we triumph and we play up how we support values of mutual aid and solidarity, but don't acknowledge that happens all the time in all kinds of contexts. For example, when Afghanis were fleeing the war on terrorism and the bombing of Kandahar and other cities in Afghanistan, they took journeys, incredible journeys, into Pakistan. I attended an event where an activist here in Montreal who went to the refugee camps in Pakistan talked to these refugees, and she heard their stories about how they would be taken in by Afghani families who had nothing while those journeys were being undertaken. You know, people who had almost nothing were providing this mutual aid and solidarity so that Afghanis could get into Pakistan. So that's the reality of migration, right? And I can go on and on. We also have to acknowledge the nature of that migration, which isn't just, you know, random. It's not just people moving. There's a pattern to the movement. It's a movement of people from the global south to the global north. It's a movement of people from the former colonized nations to the colonizing nations. It's a movement of people from the third world to places like North America, Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, as well as Israel, and as well as the rich Arab states like Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates. This is a reflection of global apartheid. You know, of if you happen to be lucky enough to have been born with a Canadian passport or a European passport or an Australian passport, that affords you certain privileges and rights. No matter how poor you are, no matter how oppressed you are, you still have certain rights, certain mobility, certain opportunity that you don't have if you have a passport from another one of those countries. And that reflects a real global apartheid and a real migration here. So that's the reality of migration. Now we have to ask ourselves, you know, why are people moving? It's a pretty obvious answer, I think, but, you know, it's not a sudden mass curiosity by brown and yellow and black people to leave their land and go somewhere else, right? There are real reasons why people leave, and historically these have been quite common and the same for hundreds of years. It's a destruction of rural communities, destruction of people's economies, unemployment, poverty, war, militarization, the forced eviction of people. One clear example of that is the issue of the Palestinians who were forcibly evicted from their homeland. Patriarchy and patriarchal violence that forces women to flee. These are all the reasons people flee. I described that ferry, you know, that cracked in two between Indonesia and Australia, and over 350 people drowning. Who was on that ferry? I said they were Algerians, Palestinians, Iraqis, and Afghanis. Well, it's obvious why Algerians, Afghanis, Palestinians, and Iraqis might want to flee. They are coming from situations of war and of violence. So that's why people are fleeing, and we have to acknowledge that because it helps us understand how we should analyze these situations. War is tied to globalization, capitalist globalization, and the ways in which that displaces people. Just to give one example, there's something called Plan Puebla Panama, which is tied to the free trade area of the Americas. This is a huge infrastructure project for southern Mexico and Central America to build dry canals, to build dams, to build airports. Basically, it's what I call capitalism's great leap forward in southern Mexico and Central America, just industrializing at a really quick pace that part of the world, which has some of the most pristine ecosystems, which has pretty intact indigenous cultures still living there. And those areas are going to be affected by Plan Puebla Panama. And where are those people going to go who are going to be displaced off their land as dams are built, or as dry canals are built, or as they're being asked to work in airports instead of on their fields? Well, that's what displacement is. That's where these refugee crises are caused from that kind of displacement. Displacement of war, displacement of capitalist economics. We could talk about structural adjustment programs, we can talk about World Bank dams, et cetera, et cetera. It's important also to acknowledge that that element of patriarchy and patriarchal violence or sexist violence. And that doesn't always express itself in mass movement. This is often a more of an individual thing, where women are experiencing this violence, but more individually, rather than on a mass scale, where you have masses of people fleeing. The point is that there are reasons for displacement, and we have to be aware of that when we're coming up with our analyses around how we deal with migration. And those reasons, war, unemployment, poverty, the displacement of people who used to live in rural economies or rural communities, that's been pretty much the same for hundreds of years. To give one example, one of the last waves of massive migration was during the Industrial Revolution, when you had literally millions of Irish people, Scottish people, Germans, Scandinavians, Eastern Europeans who were leaving their land to come elsewhere. Today, you have literally millions of Chinese who are leaving, who are displaced from their rural economies because of industrialization, massive industrialization, which is funded by the World Bank, the IMF, and various other Western nations, and they're trying to get elsewhere as well. This is a permanent state of migration. But of course, those Chinese who are coming here are not acknowledged in the same way that that British and British or Irish were back in the 18th and 19th century. So just to go on here, you have this massive migration, right? And there are good reasons why people are moving from their land to another place. War, globalization, etc. And at exactly the same time that you have this unprecedented movement of people ever in human history, like I said, 175 million people a year, each one of whom has their own story, each one of whom is practicing an act of self-determination, at exactly that same time, you have unprecedented barriers going up to people's movement in those colonizing nations of the world, in that global apartheid that I was talking about, in the US, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. They even have words for it. People have talked about Fortress North America. Tony Blair has talked about Fortress Europe. Before Tony Blair and Jacques Chirac were disagreeing about the war in Iraq, because Tony Blair wanted to occupy Iraq so that British companies could have contracts, and Jacques Chirac wanted things to be the same so that French companies could have contracts in Iraq. Before they were disagreeing about Iraq, they were agreeing about Fortress Europe. So you have Fortress North America, Fortress Europe, and in Australia and New Zealand, they call it the Pacific Solution. They even use that term, Pacific Solution. And you have to ask, a fortress against who? A solution against who? I mean, the language is really telling. It's very racist language when you look at the color of migration. If you look at the nature of migration, right? And these very same countries, Canada, the US, Germany, Britain, France, Australia, New Zealand, these are the countries that pat themselves on the back as being open to migrants, as being open to refugees and immigrants. Keep in mind, this is another important statistic, 70% of people who are migrating, so 70% of these 175 million people that are moving every year, don't get to their choice destination of Canada, the US, or Western Europe. They're migrating to another third world country. The bulk of those Afghani refugees didn't end up in the US or Canada. We didn't airlift them here. They ended up in Iran and Pakistan. Palestinian refugees end up in other third world countries for the most part, etc. So it's other third world countries that are actually welcoming the refugees, but it's our countries, the Western countries, that are patting themselves on the back. Now, how do these barriers go up? There are a lot of ways they're going up, and certainly after September 11th, there's been all kinds of excuses to accelerate the process of these barriers going up. You reduce legal aid to people who are making claims. You reduce services. You militarize borders. You reduce people's access to work. You reduce people's access to health care and social assistance. You make it easier to reject people at the border. You bring in something called Safe Third Country, which a lot of countries have brought in, which allows the immediate deportation of people who are coming from a so-called Safe Third Country. You can declare airports or border areas international zones. So if someone gets to an airport, they're technically not in your country. You speed up the deportation process. You increase detentions. You bring in the military to deal with what they call interdiction. For example, Australia has used their military to stop ships coming from Indonesia to Australia and force them into other countries. These are some of the general ways in which these barriers are going up, and the way in which Fortress North America, Fortress Europe, and the Pacific Solution is being imposed. I want to talk more specifically about Canada, say, so we can look in detail about how this plays out. So in Canada, we have a few things that have been brought in recently that have put into place, or beginning to put into place, Fortress North America, creating Fortress North America, as I refer to in my handout. And this belies our reputation as a, this welcoming country. For example, there's something called the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, which was passed in June 2002, formerly known as Bill C-11, which allows increased detentions, which allows for limited appeals. A single judge now can decide a life or death case. Before, you had at least two judges, right? So at least you have that certainty that if somebody has a doubt on a life and death case, the reasonable doubt will lie with keeping the person here. But now it's the other way around. There's not that extra doubt, and people can be deported. It bans people who are on welfare from sponsoring their relatives, et cetera, et cetera. Another plank of Fortress North America in Canada is Safe Third Country. We brought in Safe Third Country to apply to the United States. So if someone comes in through the U.S., into Canada, they can immediately be deported to the U.S. This is going to be introduced very soon. It's already in the books. It's just a matter of it being applied. This eliminates anywhere from 25% to 40% of all refugee claims from ever being heard because they come through the U.S. And keep in mind, who the U.S. considers a refugee and who Canada considers a refugee is still quite different. Back in the 1980s, if you were from Nicaragua or El Salvador, Canada would consider you a refugee. The U.S. wouldn't because of their own geopolitical concerns, because Reagan was busy making Nicaragua and El Salvador safe for democracy. We also have something called the Smart Border, which was signed by Canada and the U.S. in December of 2000, several months after September 11th. The Smart Border equation is the following. You take stupid border officials on one side of the border, and you add them to stupid border officials on the other, and you get a smart border suddenly. Because all the Smart Border really is the militarization of the Canadian-American border, the introduction of the National Guard, the sharing of information about citizens on both sides, which leads to some gross abuses of justice. For example, Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen, a dual Canadian-Syrian citizen who the U.S. deported to Syria and now is languishing in a Syrian jail when he should have come back to Canada. He went to on vacation, came back through Washington or New York, I forget the U.S. city, but in any case, he got deported back to Syria. Sharing technologies like biometrics, using iris scans, etc., etc. This is the Smart Border. Another component of the Smart Border is the introduction of the Northern Command as part of the U.S. military. The U.S. military literally carves up the world in different command structures. You have the Southern Command, based in Miami, Florida, which is responsible for the entire South America, Central America region. You have Central Command, which is based in Tampa, which had its forward headquarters in Qatar during the Gulf War, or the Second Gulf War, or the Second Iraq War, and they're responsible for the entire Middle East region. Pacific Command is responsible for the entire Pacific Rim. And now you have the Northern Command, responsible for North America. And it exposes the insidiousness of Fortress North America. And to tie it back to this idea of displacement, what you have is the following. You have Southern Command, or Central Command. Southern Command, which is responsible, for Plan Colombia and Plan Puebla, Panama. It's America's muscle in Central America and South America. And America's muscle in South America and Central America causes refugees to flee. And where do they go? Well, some of them go to the United States. Some of them were in that truck in Texas and suffocated to death. The Central Command are the ones responsible for the bombing of Baghdad, the bombing of Kandahar and Kabul, creating a whole other set of refugees. And if these people end up in North America, or if they try to get to North America, what are they going to be faced with? Well, they're going to be faced with Northern Command. They're faced with military that causes their displacement. And when they try to deal with with the issue of displacement, when they try to exercise an act of self-determination, like anybody would, they're being faced with the military. So this is just exposes, again, the insidiousness of what's happening, and it's, again, very racist as well. There's other things as well. I mean, these are some of the three things I just mentioned, the Immigration Refugee Protection Act, the Safe Third Country, the Smart Border. These are the three planks. But there's other things as well. There's specifics, you know, specific changes in policy. For example, last year, Canada lifted a moratorium on deportations to Algeria. Algeria has had a civil conflict. Over 100,000 people have died in that civil conflict since 1992. During that civil conflict, Algerians have fled to France, to Belgium, to Spain, to England, to Canada, to the United States. They were protected since 1997 from being deported because of a moratorium, and that was lifted as part of this introduction of Fortress North America. Why was it lifted? Well, we can speculate, but around the same time it was lifted, Jean Chrétien, just before the G8 meeting in Kananaskis, was in Algeria signing a trade deal with the Algerian government. Algeria is the number one economic partner with Canada in that region of the world. It has a significant amount of natural gas reserves. There's also beyond you know, these three things I talked about, beyond the specifics like lifting the moratorium on Algerians, you could talk about other changes to policy. For example, Palestinian refugees used to be accepted at a rate of around 90 to 95%. As I said, Palestinians are almost the classic they are the classic definition of a refugee. People who are forcibly evicted from their land and live in refugee camps. And now, since September 11th, they're being deported back to refugee camps. You know, it just makes no sense. So these are some of the specific changes in policy. But there's also the structural problems, you know. So beyond these policy changes, whether it's Immigration Refugee Protection Act, or whether it's a lifting of a moratorium, or whether it's like a subtle change in policy where Palestinians who were accepted now are not being accepted, you have the structural problems with immigration refugee laws in Canada. For example, to be an immigrant in Canada, you have a point system. You get points, and if you have a certain amount of points, you get in. So if you speak English, you get a certain amount of points. If you speak French, you get a little bit more. If you're under 40, you get some more. If you have $1 million, you get more. If you have a degree, good. If your degree is in engineering, good. You know, all that kind of stuff. But the way the point system works, and the way the point system has been modified, you basically have to be Superman or Superwoman to become an immigrant to Canada. Now, I'm exaggerating slightly, but there was an interesting article written where some famous Canadians, like Margaret Atwood and Pierre Burton and other people, you know, famous Canadians, were, this point system was applied to them. And you'd be amazed at the people who wouldn't be able to immigrate into Canada if you just used the point system who are here already, who were born here. If this point system applied to the generation of people who immigrated to Canada in the 60s and 70s and 80s, my parents, probably a lot of your parents, you know, this whole generation of people that constitutes cities like Toronto and Montreal, you know, and Vancouver, like these cities are made up of that generation of immigrants, they would never have been able to come. My mother would never have been able to qualify under the point system as it's set up today. So there's structural problems. And the refugee system is also structurally flawed because you basically have to prove you have a gun to your head to be a refugee. And not everybody can prove they had a gun to their head to be a refugee. Being a refugee is much more subtle and not as tangible as that. So there are these structural problems. And then, of course, there's the whole framing of the debate around immigrants and refugees. Just to give one example, here's a cover story from Maclean's in December of 2002, just December of last year. And Maclean's is not a tabloid, you know, magazine. It's like a mainstream magazine, a serious magazine. You know, it's mainstream, but it's not tabloid. It's not like the Toronto Sun or Le Journal. But here's their cover, immigrants. How many is too many? Who should get in? Can we tell them where to live and what to do? And this is a framing of the debate. I mean, imagine if it was just like Canadians. Can we tell them where to live and what to do? We'd say, fuck off. Yet, when it comes to immigrants, another set of human beings, can we tell them what to do? Can we tell them where to live? And, you know, there's an article in here by a guy named Daniel Stoffman who gets a lot more attention than he deserves. He's a critic of immigration refugee system. He says, fixing the refugee mess. Well, I agree that we should fix the refugee mess if the refugee mess is defined as war and globalization, capitalist globalization, and all these causes I talked about before of why people are displaced. But of course, his idea of the refugee mess is the refugees. They're the mess. They're the problem. The people who are exercising these acts of self-determination, who are being made to feel ashamed for who they are. Again, these are all things I'm mentioning to provide a starting point for having an analysis and explaining this emerging movement that's been called "No One Is Illegal" or "Open the Borders," or in the U.S. they've been using this term now, "Homeland Resistance," as a way of countering homeland security. I think it's important to also ground ourselves in history, because this isn't anything new. Just to limit ourselves to Canadian history and to limit ourselves to this, not this century, but the 20th century, we had an era where there was a head tax imposed on Chinese people. So if Chinese people wanted to come to Canada, they had to pay per head. These are the Chinese migrants, by the way. I mean, we are rejecting Chinese migrants now as economic refugees. They're not real refugees because they're fleeing China because of industrialization. And yet, practically every kilometer of the railway in Canada has a Chinese migrant who died because they were given the most dirtiest and dangerous jobs when the railway was being built. And yet today, they can't come. In any case, there used to be a head tax on Chinese migrants. And today, that's acknowledged as an unjust thing. Every major political figure will say it was wrong. Canada has even apologized officially for the head tax on Chinese. We had a de facto whites-only immigration policy up until the 1950s. That's why we had a head tax on Chinese, to prevent them from coming. Some of the worst riots, in Canadian history were not at a Stanley Cup celebration. They weren't at a globalization protest. The worst riots in Canadian history were riots against Chinese and Japanese in Vancouver in 1907. They were race riots. Actually, it's not even properly described as a race riot because it was the white community attacking Chinese in 1907. They were the worst riots in Canadian history. Something to keep in mind when people glorify riots. I mean, I have nothing against the right kind of riot, but not all riots are cool, and certainly these kind weren't. Sikh Punjabi migrants in 1914 were on a ship called the Kamagatamaru. India at the time was a British colony. They were coming to Canada as British subjects, and they weren't even allowed to get off the boat off the coast of BC. And they spent 2 months on a squalid boat, and they weren't allowed to get off, and they had to return back to India. That's a story that every Punjabi growing up in Canada learns at some point, because it's part of Punjabi history in Canada. In the 1940s, Jewish refugees fleeing from Nazi-occupied Europe, another classic definition of a refugee, Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi-occupied Germany, fleeing the Holocaust, weren't able to come into Canada. Our policy at the time was called "None is too many." None is too many. That's what they called it at the time. And of course, we interned the Japanese citizens back in the 1940s. Now, how does that all relate to what's happening today? Well, there's parallels. We don't have a head tax on Chinese Canadians, but for everybody who makes a humanitarian and refugee claim, a humanitarian and compassionate grounds claim, to come to Canada as a refugee. So you're asking to come to this country on a humanitarian claim. So for example, you might say, well, look, my family was massacred. I think for humanitarian reasons, I should be allowed to stay in Canada. Or you could say, I've lived here for 10 years. I have children that were born here, etc. You're fleeing genuine oppression. There's all kinds of reasons why you might make a humanitarian claim. To make a humanitarian claim in Canada, it costs $550 per head. Okay? That's the modern-day version of a head tax. Because who are the kinds of people making humanitarian claims? Well, it's not just Chinese anymore. It's masses of people, but they are people who are racialized. Brown, black, oriental people. We haven't had race riots in Canada since, to the best of my knowledge of history, since the 1930s when Jews were attacked in Toronto during the Christie Pitts riots. There were attacks against Jews, anti-Semitic attacks against Jews back then. But we haven't had race riots. But we've had racist scares related to immigrants and refugees. Back in the 1980s, there was this whole racist backlash against Tamils and Sikhs because there were one boatload of Tamils, one boatload of Sikhs that landed off the coast of Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. And that brought in a whole set of regressive legislation by the Mulroney government. That Immigration and Refugee Protection Act I talked about, brought in by the Liberals, who are supposed to be the pro-immigrant party, was brought in response to another racist scare. I'm not sure people remember, but back in 1999, there were two boatloads of Chinese migrants that landed off the coast of British Columbia. And there was a whole racist backlash at the time. The front page of the Victoria Times columnist newspaper had a headline that said, "Go home," in relation to those migrants. They were detained, immediately detained. Children, women, and men were detained. I remember, because I was going out to BC a lot at the time, I used to live there, a cover story, after the Go Home story in the Victoria Times columnist, there was another story, one of those feel-good stories, about a dog on one of the ships that came that had puppies. And about the SPCA being inundated with phone calls by the citizens of Victoria to adopt these puppies. Now, you know, I have no problem with animal welfare. I think it's great that homeless puppies are being taken care of. But at the same time, you had Chinese migrants in the hundreds who were being detained in detention centers and being scapegoated and also being deported. They deported 90 of them on a plane. The officials, the police officials and immigration officials got commemorative t-shirts when they did that. They made commemorative t-shirts that said the class of 90, referring not to the year 1990, but to the 90 people they deported. So the racist backlash still occurred. I talked about no one is too many in relation to Jewish refugees back in the 1940s. Well, Safe Third Country has been called the no one is too many policy. Because what we're saying is if you come from the U.S., if you're like a Central American or from Mexico, or for whatever reason you land in the U.S. and try to get into Canada, none is too many. We're going to send you right back. And the internment of the Japanese. Well, we haven't yet interned groups of people because of their ethnic identity. We haven't done that recently. But we do have policies like, for example, in the U.S., registrations, forced registrations. There's a list of countries, mainly Arab countries, Muslim countries, a few others. If you're from those countries, even if you're a naturalized resident of the U.S., you're forced to go to an INS office and register. And register means you give your name, your address, your fingerprints, take a photo, and answer their questions. I think registration is the modern-day form of internment. Because all internment is about, not all it's about, what it's about is physically controlling people, right? Keeping them in one place. Well, there's a lot of different ways to control people. One way is physically put them in a detention center or a concentration camp. Another way to physically control people is force them to report every month and take their fingerprints and take their photographs. If they don't show up, they're illegal. And you can go out and arrest them. And you can make SWAT team raids on them. That's another way of controlling people. And actually, it's a more palatable way of controlling people. Because if they were in detention centers, there'd be an uproar, I think. Much more of an uproar than there is right now, when literally millions of American people who happen to be from Iran or Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or wherever are forced to register every month and are being deported because they haven't lived up to some aspect of their visa. And sometimes the stories are just atrocious. Like, for example, students at a Colorado university who took one less course than they were supposed to because they dropped a course just before the deadline. Everybody drops courses just before the deadline, right? I mean, yeah, geez, I'm going to fail this course if I don't drop it. So you drop it. And immigrant students do the same thing. But they were detained. So, you know, you drop a course, you might get into trouble from, you know, whatever, your parents. A foreign student does that, and they're on this registration list, and they get raided by a SWAT team, and they get put into a detention center, and they get deported. So that history, that grounding ourselves in history is important. I just want to run ahead here so we can have time for discussion. We are allowed to go a little bit over because we started late, so lunch will be a little late too. One point I want to make, it's really important, is that these policies, this creation of Fortress North America, Fortress Europe, etc., is not necessarily meant to keep people out. Because people are getting in, and it's obvious that immigrants, migrants, are part of the populations that make up societies like North America, Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, more and more and more. An analysis around migration is also an analysis around class. To talk about no one is illegal is to talk about class, because to talk about class is to talk about how migration and how the working class today is racialized. Because when I say these policies aren't necessarily meant to keep people out, what I'm saying is look at who does work in our societies, you know? Look at who's pumping gas, who's working in the backs of kitchens, you know, in kitchens, in restaurants, who's working in the agricultural fields picking fruit and vegetables or picking tobacco, who's working in sweatshops, who's working in construction, who's doing all kinds of manual labor. Our economies, especially economies in places like California or Texas or New Jersey, but also Canada, is based on this migration. So it's not necessarily meant to keep people out. There's people who get in. But what is happening, and the real reason for these policies is to reduce the status of people, to reduce their ability to claim full rights, to not make them full citizens, to make them illegal, to make them non-status, to make them temporary. And by doing so, you make people that much more exploitable. Because if people come with full rights, imagine if people had full rights immediately. Imagine if every migrant laborer working in those agricultural fields had full rights. They didn't have to worry about being deported or being fired because, you know, they have no rights. Well, they'd assert those rights. There are people who'd make sure those rights would be asserted. So this is the nature of this migration. So it's not about keeping people out. It's about if they're getting in, we control, you know, how much rights they can claim. So Fortress North America is about managing migration for the interests of capitalism, right? And that's what I mean about confronting capitalism, because confronting migration is confronting capitalism, confronting the way migration is so unjust. Now, I've used this term apartheid, and I've already referred to how there's a global apartheid, in the sense that if you happen to have a passport from one nation, you're afforded certain rights that you're not afforded if you have passports from other nations. And that's similar to actual apartheid, which is, you know, if you have marked on your passport white, you had certain rights, and if you had marked colored or black or whatever, you didn't have certain rights. You know, in South Africa, the classic model of an apartheid state. Apartheid means separation. That's the actual meaning of the word in Afrikaans. It also has other connotations, like having separate sets of rights for separate sets of people. It also means invisibility, that somebody's reality or a group of people's reality is invisible to people. So that's how I'm using the term apartheid. And I talked about global apartheid, but there's also what I call domestic apartheid or internal apartheid based on these policies that we see more and more with the post-September 11th environment, but you saw beforehand as well. When we talk about two realities, the reality of being legal and having status and the reality of being illegal and being non-status. And being illegal and being non-status, by the way, there's a lot of those people. They're in the millions. In Canada, they're in the hundreds of thousands. In the U.S., they're in the millions. They are doing all kinds of work in the U.S. When the World Trade Center, just to go right back to September 11th, where it all started, when those planes went into the Twin Towers and the Twin Towers fell, a lot of people never claimed bodies or tried to claim bodies because they knew the people who were working there were illegal and they were worried about themselves being deported, right? A lot of the people who worked in the area of September 11th who were directly affected in two ways, because they were working in restaurants or had stands, and they were illegal, but they were doing that work, and their economic livelihood was destroyed because of what happened, you know, like that whole area was destroyed. And then they would go back to their homes in Brooklyn or New Jersey or the Bronx, and they're worried that they're going to be raided, and they were raided, and they were detained, and they were deported, right? So we do have not the stark apartheid where, you know, you have the passport mark, but a real de facto apartheid existing, these two sets of realities. And those realities exist as well in terms of the invisibility of our majorities in the world. In general, right, the third world is always invisible. That reality is invisible. Like, the fact that an American soldier dies is going to get a lot more attention than the reality of, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of Palestinians that are dying every single day. But those invisible realities are also here in our societies. For example, I collect articles about this stuff. And, you know, for example, back in August of 2002, just outside Montreal, on a farm on Saint-Hyacinthe, there were 20 Mexican migrant workers, temporary migrant workers, who were deported. They come in on temporary work permits, and they do some of the most backbreaking work, working in, you know, fields, like literally 7 days a week working. Sometimes they get a day off. Some of these people did, and apparently there was a lot of alcohol, and there was a fight. There were no arrests, but immediately they were deported. It turns out, actually, when it was explored more by people, that a couple of them were trying to organize. And since they were trying to organize, they got deported. Again, this invisible reality. I mean, we're getting these foods on our tables every day, but just literally 20 minutes, 30 minutes outside of Montreal on the South Shore, this reality is existing. This apartheid reality is existing. We don't even see it. I'll give another example. A guy by the name of Ned Livingston Peart died in August of 2002, last summer. We'll see what happens this summer, but, you know, these Mexicans got deported last summer. Ned Livingston Peart died working on a tobacco field, harvesting the tobacco crop in southwestern Ontario, where there's a lot of tobacco. A kiln fell on him, and he died. The health and safety legislation does not apply to those farm workers. They can't refuse dangerous working conditions that a citizen could refuse. You know, you could refuse a dangerous working condition if you're in your job, technically. I'm not saying it's perfect, but technically you can refuse dangerous work condition and you won't be fired. But they can't. They're exposed to dangerous chemicals, etc. And all those factors came into play when this kiln fell on Ned and he died. And of course, the double factor here is that, you know, his family didn't even have the, couldn't even have the certainty of knowing that they would get the body back. They had to pay for his body to come back because it wasn't covered by any workplace, you know, fund or anything. So I can go on and on and name other names. Shakir Balak, who was detained, domestic workers. There was a woman here in Montreal, Fatima Marful, who lived here for 12 years, a Moroccan woman who got deported after living here for 12 years and being exploited in a variety of jobs, working for basically, you know, one of the worst jobs to have, which is taking care of rich people's kids. That's what she did. And she was exploited by her bosses, and after 12 years, she was deported. I mean, this is the invisible reality we don't see. And again, these people number in the hundreds of thousands in Canada and in the millions in the U.S., in the millions in Europe, etc. And part of this apartheid as well is about separate rights. The premise is also racist as well, because what's being practiced is collective punishment. Basically, if you're brown, if you're Muslim, if you come from a certain community, you're forced to answer for everyone else in your community. And that's not applied to anybody else. For example, if you're Muslim, you're forced to answer for Osama bin Laden. You know, you have to answer for him because you are being targeted by the state. You are being profiled. You are on this list of countries in the United States that has to register. Imagine if you applied that logic of being forced to answer for other members of your culture, every other member of your culture. That would mean that when Timothy McVeigh was found guilty of bombing the federal building in Oklahoma City, every other white male would have to answer for Timothy McVeigh. Well, of course, every other white male doesn't have to answer for him. But why does every brown person, every Muslim person have to answer for every other Muslim person in the world? Well, that's collective punishment. That's the racist reality of what we're dealing with. That's how these policies have never gone away when we look at it historically. And just to talk about the racism a bit more, it's very real. Like, it's used. It's used electorally. For example, in Ontario right now, there's going to be an election in the upcoming weeks. Ernie Eves is the premier. He took over from Mike Harris. Bob Runciman is the public security minister there. They're arguing that the provinces should take control of immigration because the Liberals are too soft. You know, the Liberals who brought in the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, who signed Safe Third Country, who brought in the Safe Border, who lifted the moratorium on Algerian refugees, who are detaining refugees at an unprecedented pace, they're too soft. So we want to take control ourselves of immigration. Runciman has openly talked about bringing in Australian-style immigration policies in Ontario. Australian-style policies are keeping people out before they can even get in by using the military, and if they get in, putting them in detention camps immediately, which they do in Australia. Woomera was an example. Baxter is another camp now. Also, Ernie Eves said, if you're on welfare, you shouldn't be allowed to sponsor a relative. What's problematic about what he said is that's already the case. That's already the policy under the new Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. So either Ernie Eves is a moron, or he's applying a very racist strategy. He's just, he's pushing the buttons. And Ernie Eves is not a moron. Mel Lastman, the mayor of Toronto, is a moron. He says things like that. Ernie Eves is not a moron, right? Like, he's not an idiot. He knows what he's doing. He's pushing those buttons. Immigrants on welfare shouldn't be allowed to sponsor refugees. Well, that's already the case, but he says it because it helps appeal to that racist dynamic that exists in Canadian society. To give other examples beyond Ontario, in Australia, when these boatloads of people were trying to come to Australia, you had Australian ministers and prime ministers saying, these people, you know, they're horrible. They're trying to throw their kids off their ships to get us to take them into our country. There was a story, this story that Australian minister was saying to the media, that Iraqi and Afghani refugees were trying to throw their kids off the ships, like showing the media cameras kids being thrown off their ships to prove how desperate they were and how Australia should take them in. That was not true. That was not true. They were throwing their kids. Look, we have kids. Let us in. They weren't trying to throw their kids off, as if an Iraqi parent or an Afghani parent somehow doesn't care about their kids, you know, and that somehow white parents in Australia care about their kids more than Iraqis. But that was the strategy used just before an election, and John Howard won the election when he got in. Now, at the anti-war rallies in Montreal, a lot of people, and we've had some of the largest anti-war rallies in North America. Actually, we had the largest the last time there were large rallies. We had over 250,000 people, larger than San Francisco and New York, comparable to all of the rallies all over the world, just second to, say, rallies in Italy or England, where they had millions. And people were carrying signs, Vive la France, Vive Chirac. You know, this is the same Chirac who, you know, openly talked about how immigrants smell a few years back in France, and that explains, you know, he's trying to siphon off that vote that goes to Jean-Marie Le Pen, who's an out-and-out fascist, right? And Chirac is just he's the bourgeois liberal, and that's what bourgeois liberals in France, you know, speculate about. And they bring in policies, again, to implement Fortress Europe in France. So I'm just going to start finishing up here. That means I'm going to take a little bit longer, but I do think it's important, and I wrote this on the handout, just the outline, to talk a little bit about indigenous struggles and indigenous sovereignty. There's all kinds of tensions and contradictions when we talk about No One Is Illegal campaigns, open border campaigns, and incorporating indigenous struggles and indigenous sovereignty. To give one example of those tensions, I talked about two boatloads of Chinese migrants that landed off the coast of British Columbia. The second time that happened, there were two women at Port Alberni, where they landed, which is on the northern tip of Vancouver Island, who had signs up that said, go home. We don't want you, go home, something like that. I forget exactly what the sign said. Those two women were indigenous women from the community of Port Alberni. So obviously there's all kinds of tensions. That's a clear tension. And there's contradictions as well, as I said. You know, how do you talk about open borders on stolen land? Because this is stolen land. And we're talking about open borders. We're talking about no one being illegal. And we're talking about this in a context of genocide. When I talk about apartheid, I talked about that word being from South Africa. The word is from South Africa. The concept, though, isn't from South Africa. The concept comes from Canada. It's one of our great contributions to world culture, along with Wayne Gretzky and maple syrup. This idea of apartheid, we didn't call it that, but our reservation system was the basis for apartheid in South Africa. But it's important to talk about indigenous struggles. I'm not going to talk about it at length right now, because that's not what my workshop is about. It's an acknowledgement of the importance of integrating that analysis. These realities I was talking about in terms of migration are neo-colonial realities, right? But neo-colonial realities presuppose colonial realities, and those colonial realities still exist when we talk about Native peoples. So that linkage is crucial. And I think one way that link is made is to talk about ending displacement, talking about ending the reasons why people are forced to be displaced from their homelands or their livelihoods, because that also applies to indigenous communities who are being displaced off their land, onto reservations, into cities, because of the way their lands and resources are being controlled. And that is a common ground that is being explored, but it's something that has to develop over a long term. So that's just my acknowledgement of that. I want to give a little critique of you know, the peace movement, anti-globalization movement. I talked a bit about anti-globalization, so I won't belabor that, except to say that an anti-capitalist, anti-globalization movement, to be truly rooted and grounded, needs to talk about migration, not as something that will bring in a whole other set of people, but integrated as a main part of the analysis. That includes talking about Plan Puebla Panama and how that displaces people. That includes talking about Fortress North America. This is part of globalization and actually exposes the hypocrisy of the way globalization is promoted by people like Pierre Pettigrew or Robert Zoellick, who's the U.S. Trade Secretary, where, you know, borders are somehow coming down to people's movement. Well, they're coming down to movement of capital, but they're going up to people's movement to enable better control of those people. But the peace movement, the emerging peace movement, or what we had as a peace movement, is, you know, is also important to critique a bit. Because as people were being mobilized for operation, you know, against Operation Iraqi Freedom, which was the name the U.S. military gave to their operation in Iraq, Operation Iraqi Freedom, at the same time that Operation Iraqi Freedom was announced, literally, when the operation was announced by George Bush, he announced something else, which people didn't hear about as much. It was another operation, which he called Operation Liberty Shield. And Operation Liberty Shield was a domestic part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Operation Liberty Shield obliged every Iraqi to come in for an interview. Operation Liberty Shield allowed for the immediate detention of anybody on that list. So beyond registering, now they could be detained. Operation Liberty Shield brought in a lot of other things that I haven't had the chance to process effectively yet because it was so overwhelming. You hear all these stories all over the place. SWAT team raid here, a new policy change there. I'm not American, so you know I try to pay attention, but not as much as I would to policies that are being changed here. But these are things that we're going to find out about more and more. But we do use that slogan, the war at home and the war abroad. And any anti-war movement needs to talk about the war at home, whether it's the war on indigenous people or Operation Liberty Shield. But of course, that wasn't being talked about. And not only was it not being talked about, but it was being openly mocked when you have people saying, Vive la France, and appealing to these states that are openly attacking their immigrant and refugee populations with policies that make them do pretty desperate things. I mention all of this as well because I think the analysis is important. It's important that that as anarchists, you know, we avoid what I call the fetishization of tactics, you know, especially like certain tactics, like getting together in black blocs. Like, I have no problem with black blocs at the right moment and stuff, but when it comes to dealing with issues around people, no one being illegal, open borders, and working as allies with populations of people who are at risk, that tactical question, you know, you can't fetishize certain tactics. They just don't apply. You have to get involved with the messiness of working with people and their reality. And that means adjusting tactics. That doesn't mean being less radical. Actually, I believe it means being more radical because you're confronting those realities. So, by way of conclusion, I guess I wanted to return to this idea of what it means to have an anarchist perspective. And I talked about it at the beginning. I'll talk about it a little bit more now. What it means is, first of all, there is emerging and existing campaigns that address all these issues. I'm not saying anything new for many, many years. But they become more deepened, I think, recently. For example, in New York City a few weeks ago, there was something called Operation Homeland Resistance, where predominantly people of color activists in New York went to the INS building and got engaged in acts of civil disobedience. You have a No One Is Legal campaign that's emerging. You have Open the Borders networks emerging. In Europe, these are really well defined. No Border campaign, border camps, etc. Working with the people who are directly affected and their reality, as I talked about before. And when you talk about people's reality, you can't be shy about acknowledging not only the fact that people are smuggled, that they use fake passports, that they're underground, that they have to lie to deal with their own reality and to have a dignified existence, but also that we have to adjust our tactics in order to work properly with people. Australia as well has had a more deepened open borders, No One Is Legal campaign, specifically in reaction to these detention centers, concentration camps that make what we have here look much better. But still, we're moving towards Australia, and Australia's not moving towards us. So those campaigns are in existence. A lot of anarchists are involved in those campaigns, but not as what I would call Circle A anarchists on your badge, on your shirt. We're anarchists and we're doing it as anarchists. No, it's applying what I talked about before, anarchism being meaningful within the context of struggle, within a struggle, and not bringing anarchism to the struggle, but having it there as people are self-organizing and actually organizing in very anarchist ways and asserting themselves and engaging in acts of self-determination that I talked about before. Maybe to be really clear about this idea of self-determination, just to give some real stories. For example, just to give some stories from the non-status Algerian campaign here in Montreal, I won't give names, but I'll give examples. When a family, say, with small children, decides that they don't want to live in a country where thousands of people are dying every year, and they decide to get fake passports, to lie, to get into France, and then finally to get into Canada, that is a very courageous and profound act of self-determination, of somebody taking control of their life. But it's never acknowledged as such, and they're meant to feel ashamed. To give another example, when a young man living in Algiers says, look, I don't want to be faced with the choice of joining the military and becoming a butcher, or joining an Islamic militia and becoming a butcher, and I'm going to leave, I'm going to get on a boat and go to Italy. And again, he eventually makes his way to Montreal. That's a profound act of self-determination. Now, that very same person, and again, this is a real story, is standing on the street, a street of Montreal at night, and gets approached by cops, and gets put into the car because he's supposedly jaywalking. And he tells them, well, you don't have your seatbelt on. He gives them a little bit of lip. And they start telling him, you know, why don't you go back to Algeria or call him a dirty Arab. And they get into a little bit of a verbal sparring match. And he tells them to fuck off. That's also an act of self-determination. That's a profound act of self-determination to tell the cop to fuck off. It's actually very profound because that person not only faces going to jail for a night and maybe getting a fine, but he faces being deported right back to Algeria. He can't act out the ways that we would act out if we were being dissed in that way by whoever we were being dissed by, whether it's a cop or whether it's anybody out on the street. And I gave these two examples. There are thousands of these examples. Every immigrant and refugee, you don't have to be an immigrant and refugee to have an act of self-determination. I mean, people have acts of self-determination all the time. Women who flee domestic violence, single moms, parents who, you know, raise children in desperate situations. Those are all acts of self-determination, but I'm you know, specifically talking about migrants and immigrants. There are thousands of these stories all over our cities. This can be a mass movement because when you talk to people about them, you're going to be talking about their reality, about their parents, about what their parents went through if you're the children of immigrants, or about what you are going through if you are an immigrant or you are a refugee. So when we talk about an anarchist perspective, it's bringing those values of mutual aid and solidarity and struggle to those struggles and asserting them in a real way and knowing what it means to be an ally. Harsha talked about this a little bit on the panel. She made an important point. It's a point that Sarita, who's talking later, makes a lot. It's the idea of knowing to be a follower while leading and knowing to lead while following. Because being an ally doesn't mean you just condescendingly say, you're a migrant, therefore whatever you say goes, or you're indigenous, therefore whatever you say goes. It rather is a comradely relationship, but understanding who's fighting the struggle, because if you're an ally, you're not the one who's directly affected. That's where I think the anarchist perspective comes in, being involved directly in those struggles. And I'm talking about one struggle, but the panel later on today, if you attended, talks about others, worker struggles, housing struggles, etc. That's where it's meaningful, not as some abstraction, not just about personal liberation. Like, I have nothing against personal liberation, but anarchism is meaningful when that liberation is bound up in other people's liberation as well. And there are masses of people who are fighting for that liberation. I mean, the Algerians in Montreal self-organized. Palestinians in Montreal are self-organizing. And even when people aren't self-organizing in groups, they're organizing as individuals. Just to get their, like, papers, they're organizing. They're doing incredible things. They can't speak the language. Sometimes they can't read or write the language. They don't have money, but they're getting organized, right? And we really play up the ways in which we get organized because we can organize a spokes council or bring 1,000 people into a city and maybe get them housed, you know. And yet, you know, people are organizing themselves in ways all the time, and we have to acknowledge that and see that, and then maybe we can break out of certain ghettos that anarchists sometimes are in. Okay, so just to finish up, which I said a few times. I guess the final point is where an anarchist perspective here is meaningful is understanding the difference between reforms and reformism. Anarchists aren't against reforms, right? Like, we're fighting for reforms all the time. If we can get a rent freeze in Montreal, we'll fight for that reform. If we can get the moratorium back on Algerians who are being deported, we'll fight for that. If we can get more liberal immigration laws, we'll fight for that. But there's a difference between reforms and reformism. Because reformism is about accommodating yourself to the system. We're fighting that system because we're acknowledging, and I talked about that right from the very beginning, that capitalism and imperialism and colonialism, these are the causes of displacement. These are the root causes of that displacement. So you can't accommodate yourself to the system. You can't talk about having a fair immigration system. Right? That's why we talk about no one being illegal. That's why we talk about open borders. Because what does a fair immigration system mean when the point of the immigration system is to exclude people or to exploit them once they're inside by not providing them with full dignity or full status, but only giving them full dignity and full status if they have a certain amount of money or they can prove that they're smart enough to be like us, actually smarter than us, because that's the way the point system works. You know, what does fair immigration mean? Does that mean like handcuffs will be on less tighter when they detain you? I mean, literally, that's sometimes what it means. And that's where an anarchist perspective within migration campaigns is very different from a lot of the liberal NGO groups who do some good work but are fighting for fair immigration and are basically dictating to people who are directly affected what they should do. For example, the Algerians in Montreal were told, you can't demand an end to a return of the moratorium. That's too radical. You can't say that there should be no deportations ever again for you and anybody else. That's too radical. While our approach, when I say our approach, I mean those allies and No One Is Legal, people who are working as allies, was like, well, if you're saying that, then that makes a lot of sense, absolutely, because that's the starting point for a struggle. So it's understanding that we can fight for given reforms, but we're not reformists. You know, we are radicals, we are revolutionaries, and when people are fighting for those radical revolutionary demands, we have to be with them on the front lines of those struggles. So I'll leave it at that, and we can have a discussion and questions. If people didn't get handouts, there's some around. So.